the company without fixing it. Enter the author of the story, a programmer named Ed Nather, who was brought into Royal McBee and asked to fix Mel's code. As he began digging into the masterpiece that Mel had left behind, he was astounded by the elegance and genius of Mel's code. I have often felt that programming is an art form, whose real value can only be appreciated by another versed in the same arcane art. There are lovely gems and brilliant coups, hidden from human view and admiration, sometimes forever, by the very nature of the process. You can learn a lot about an individual just by reading through his code, even in hexadecimal. Mel was, I think, an unsung genius. Mel refused the help of any compilers or assemblers. He wrote in straight hex code, which looks like this. 79, 6F, 75, 20, 61, 72, 65, 20, 6E, 6F, 74, 20, 79, 6F, 75, 72, 20, 6D, 69, 6E, 64. The author writes reverently of Mel's machine-level hacks, such as writing the innermost parts of his program loops first so they would get first choice of the optimum address locations on the drum. In other words, optimizing his code at the lowest possible level so that his programs would run with maximum efficiency on the LGP-30. Mel and the computer were one. In the end, the author is so awestruck by Mel's coding mastery that he feels he cannot make any changes. It would be like touching up the Mona Lisa's smile. He tells his boss he can't figure it out and writes this homage to Mel instead, in which Mel becomes the archetype of the real programmer, the one to whom all other programmers aspire. When we choose our positive thought loops, we are looking for that same sense of efficiency and optimization. When you think of the five goals you wrote in the previous chapter, what is the thought loop that will get you there? Choose your thought loops carefully, for they will determine the future direction of your life. Constructing new loops. The key to constructing positive thought loops is looking for alternative or balanced thoughts to replace the negative things that you've been telling yourself for years. Instead of automatically repeating the negative thoughts when certain situations arise, you want your mind to automatically repeat these positive thoughts instead. And as with Mel, you want to strive for precision and elegance in the wording of these loops. For example, Jim's boss gives the team their monthly sales goals on the first of each month. Jim always has a nagging feeling of doom in the week leading up to it. I'm not good enough. I won't meet my goals. I'll fail and be fired. Instead, Jim could construct a positive thought loop, like, I'm good at my job. Or even better, I'm the top salesperson in my office. Or better still, I'm brilliant at helping my company and our customers succeed. Note with this last loop, he is enlarging his boundaries of what is possible, not just focusing on keeping his job by a thread, but actively adding value to the world. Take Robbie, who is still feeling guilty over the fact that she argued with her father a week before he died. Whenever someone mentions death, or sometimes when she's just sitting at her desk, her mind flashes back to that moment and she thinks, I'm a horrible daughter. Her new positive loop could read, I'm a good daughter. Or even better, I'm a good person. Or better still, I'm at peace with myself and getting better every day. Note that the example of Jim is triggered by an external event, and the example of Robbie is triggered by an internal event. The negative thought loop that gets kicked off in each of them is similar, a feeling of not being good enough. As they become aware of these thought loops through the concentration games and identification techniques in the previous section, they are now armed with a powerful tool, an alternative thought. Let's take a final example, which is very close to my heart and lungs, getting free of alcohol and drugs. In the first few weeks of sobriety, there was only one thought going through my head. I will never have fun again. I was sure that lifelong sobriety was a ticket to boredom and unhappiness. No more drunken cow tipping in Vermont. No more riding kiddie coasters while high as a hang glider. I suppose I could have thought,
sobriety is fun.
That felt like an outright lie. I could have thought,
I'm happy to be sober.
I'm glad I settled on this positive loop.
I'm grateful for my sobriety.
There is a great deal of research on the transformative power of thankfulness. In a series of studies by psychologists Robert A. Emmons and Michael E. McCullough, three groups of people were given a different writing assignment for several weeks. One group listed five things for which they were grateful. One group listed five things that annoyed them, and a control group listed five things that had taken place during the week. The results were dramatic. Those in the gratitude group felt better about their lives, were physically healthier, slept better, spent more time exercising, were more likely to offer support to others, and were more optimistic about the future. A follow-up survey sent to the spouses and partners of participants confirmed that they noticed a positive difference as well. The researchers struggled to define thankfulness, but the definition I like best is savoring the positive circumstances of life. There are many positive circumstances in your life, whether that's your health, your friends, your intellectual capacity, your job, or just the fact that you're reading this book. On a daily basis, you can find something to appreciate, whether it's a good meal, a fine sunset, or a hearty laugh. Feeding this gratefulness into your positive loops can have a powerful, life-altering impact, as it did for me. By repeating, "I'm grateful for my sobriety," day in and day out, I have found that I genuinely am grateful for my sobriety. I've gone from seeing it as a curse to a blessing. In fact, my sobriety is now like a precious treasure. Choosing your loops. In the Academy Award-winning movie Inception, Leonardo DiCaprio leads a different kind of mind-hacking team. Inception is a mind-bending science fiction heist movie about a team that hacks not into bank vaults, but into people's minds as they sleep. Using a secret military technology, DiCaprio's team is able to enter a shared dream with their target without that person's knowledge, even implanting an idea into the person's subconscious, a technique called inception. As the movie progresses, we learn the backstory. DiCaprio and his wife once entered a shared dream where they spent 50 years together in this alternate world, building massive cityscapes and seemingly growing old together. His wife began to fall in love with the dream reality, never wishing to return to real life. Unable to convince her, DiCaprio secretly placed an idea into her subconscious. This is not real. The idea took root, and they finally woke up from their shared dream to find that only 3 hours had passed. But that idea, "this is not real," was so deeply planted in his wife's mind that she could not escape it even when she was back in the real world. Convinced she was still dreaming, she asked DiCaprio to jump off a building with her before making the leap herself. The movie contains three or four layers of meta-goodness, dreams within dreams within dreams, and leaves you with deep, unsettling questions about what reality really is. One of the critical messages of Inception is that implanting an idea in someone's mind can have a far-reaching impact on the person's life, for good as well as bad. We want to use care in choosing our mental loops. If you're writing code to regulate an automatic braking system or land a plane, a bug can literally result in lost lives. Similarly, choosing a loop like, "I'm the most important person in the world," or "I have absolute power over all my enemies," repeated millions of times, can lead to behaviors that are ultimately destructive to you and the world. Put another way, be careful what you wish for. Remember, your loops create your thoughts create your actions, and your actions create your life. This is not meant to paralyze you with indecision, a surprisingly common problem among geeks, but to encourage you to consider your positive loops carefully. Here are some tips that may help. Include the word I. Instead of self-confidence, think, "I am self-confident." Frame it in the first person, as if you are in control, which you are. Ask, "What do I want?" As with training a child or dog, keep it in the positive. Instead of, "I'm not so self-critical," try, "I'm gentle with myself." Think big. Think, "How can I enlarge my sense of what's possible?" Instead of, "My business is making $20 million, try, "I'm a successful entrepreneur adding massive value to the world." Create value. Ask yourself how you can add maximum value, not just to yourself, but to society. Instead of, "My wife and I get along," or, "I have a successful marriage," try something like, "Our relationship is a model to the world." Have fun with it. Take the five goals from section 2.2 and write a positive thought loop corresponding with each. These are meant to correspond with each of the following goals. 1. Feel. From the mood chip, how do you want to feel? Peaceful? Confident? Happy? Thinking back to your debugging techniques, look for the positive alternatives that you'd like to use to counteract your negative thoughts and feelings. Use these as your +2 weapons of mental fortitude. For example, "I am strong, secure, and confident. I am mentally calm, poised, and relaxed." Or, "I am comfortable in my own skin." 2. Do. From the $50 million inheritance, what experience would you like to have in life? You may want to make a moonshot goal, a big dream to pursue over your lifetime, or you may want to start with a shorter-term goal, something in the next year. For example, "I'm an accomplished traveler," or "I'm making the dean's list." 3. Have. From The Genie in the Lamp, what thing would you like to own? I believe we can run into trouble by focusing too much on material possessions, but this one can be fun if we concentrate on how they can add value to society. For example, "I own a beautiful house where we throw many fine parties." Or, "I have my own jet, which I use to host my private mind-hacking retreats." 4. Give. From Your Evolution Contribution, what is it that you want to give back to the world? Remember that society generally rewards those who give it what it wants, in equal measure to the value created. So the bigger you think, the greater your potential reward. "I am eradicating malaria," and "I am making internet access available to the entire planet," are great goals, but so is "I am creating music that benefits the world," and
I am raising a magnificent family.
5. B. From the funeral speech, who is it that you want to be? This is not what you want other people to say about you, but what kind of person you want to be at your core. Ben Franklin's list of 13 virtues are an excellent place to start, as he consolidated them from many centuries of great philosophers and thinkers before him. For example, I am trustworthy, always following through on my promises. Or, I am generous, freely giving of my talents to benefit the world. Choosing these loops can be hard work, and if you already suffer from the curse of perfectionism, you may just need to write, I give things my best effort and happily move on, thus giving it your best effort and happily moving on. As much as I've said about choosing your loops well, I now want to encourage you to actually make a choice. The award-winning psychologist M. Scott Peck once said that as long as our will is firmly committed toward the good, we can trust that our subconscious is at least one step ahead of our conscious and thus feels secure in our decisions. Besides, just as with coding, you can always rewrite your positive loops later. Begin mind game. Writing your positive loops. Complete the 5 imagination games in this chapter. Write down each positive thought loop on the practice sheet. Focus on getting it done, not getting it perfect. You can always rewrite your code later. End mind game. You've now learned how to become aware of your mind, identify your negative thinking, and properly code positive thought loops to drive your mind in new directions of happiness and success. One thing still remains, however, you have to do the work. If we leave off here, we're like the programmer who dreams up an amazing new app but never finishes it. We are like the aspiring musician who dreams of the stage but rarely practices. We are like the person with big dreams, but who exerts little effort in bringing them to fruition. In the next section, you'll learn techniques for reprogramming your mind. These are the day-in, day-out practices that you'll use to bring your ideas into the world. Backed by research and proven by science, these mind hacks will teach you how to make your dreams a reality. Let the true mind hacking begin. Part 3. Reprogramming. 3.1. Write. Visiting the Thomas Edison National Historical Park in West Orange, New Jersey should be on every geek's list of things to do in life. Advertised as Where Modern America Was Invented, it's an enormous brick building where, for more than 40 years, Edison's team of geniuses turned out innovation after innovation, including the motion picture camera and movies, improved phonographs and sound recordings, and electric inventions like the alkaline storage battery. It was the Google of its day. Edison is remembered today as a prolific inventor, over 1,000 patents in his name, but perhaps his most important invention was the process of invention itself. The meta-invention of how to make more inventions is Edison's true legacy. Edison invented the modern research and development facility, and if you go to West Orange, you can still walk through it. It's fascinating and instructive to see how Edison laid out the complex. Tucked away in a corner of his expansive office was a small bed. Edison was a believer in the power of power naps. After ruminating on a difficult problem, he would retire in the corner for a microsleep, letting his mind work on a solution. When the idea came to him, he would hurry to his desk and write it down. He would then rush upstairs to his second, more modest office where he did his true inventing. Here he would take the initial idea and sketch it out,
making rough drawings of the idea that he wanted to pull into reality. Next door to this office was a drafting room where a team of draftsmen would take his ideas and begin drawing up formal plans. What parts would be needed? What materials would they be made of? Wrestling with these questions, with occasional input from the master, they would work up large-scale drawings from which the invention could now be built. From there, the drawings went to a machine shop full of small electric tools. Frequently, they needed to build machines to build the machines that would build the inventions. In this first shop, they could fabricate any small parts needed. These parts went below to a large-scale machine shop, a huge loft space filled with motorized pulleys, belts, and gears that could provide the power to manufacture the invention itself. Thomas Edison once bragged about his facility. "We can build anything from a lady's watch to a locomotive." From an idea, to paper, to plans, to machining, to manufacturing, to a finished product. It was an early prototype of today's R&D labs. I want to highlight what Edison did first when his mammoth mind presented him with an idea to feed into that amazing system. In order to turn that idea into a reality, he wrote it down. There is a power and a magic in writing things down that we take for granted because we do it so often. First, an idea is only in our mind, with no expression in the physical world. Then, with a few strokes of a pencil or a few awkward taps of our thumbs, that idea is now a thing. True, it may only be a representation of the thing, but it's still here, in this world. Writing is a bridge, or a gateway, between the world of mind and the world of matter. It's how thoughts become things. It's how an idea gets from our heads into our hands. While this may seem basic and obvious, think back to how often you have given yourself a resolution for self-improvement or had a great idea to transform the world and you did not write it down. Be honest, what was the result? Take the goal of losing weight, for example. The World Health Organization estimates that 10% of people worldwide are obese, leading to increased risk of heart disease, strokes, diabetes, and some forms of cancer, the leading causes of preventable death. So a 2008 study, funded by the National Institutes of Health, recruited nearly 1,700 overweight people to experiment with a new approach to losing weight, food diaries. In addition to education and collaboration, the secret weapon in this approach was keeping a food diary, with participants keeping a list of everything they ate, whether that be on a pad of sticky notes or a digital device. While common sense says that keeping a diary would not result in any meaningful weight loss, the participants found that knowing their food choices would be recorded rather than eaten and forgotten was a powerful motivator to making better choices. Further, they began to notice patterns in their eating that could only be appreciated when they could write them down and take the meta view. The results were astounding. The more food records people kept, the more weight they lost, said the study's author, Dr. Jack F. Hollis. Those who kept daily food records lost twice as much weight as those who kept no records. It seems that the simple act of writing down what you eat encourages people to consume fewer calories. I've come to appreciate writing as a powerful and advanced technology, whether we're scribbling it on a notepad or typing it on a keyboard. When we write down our ideas, thoughts, or resolutions, we have a record. As Jonah Lehrer put it in his book, Imagine How Creativity Works, there was nothing, now there is something. It's almost like magic. Begin call out. Until it's on paper, it's vapor. End call out. The book before the book. One of the first people to formally develop a plan for treating alcoholics was Dr. Richard R. Peabody. Peabody, you should know, was not a doctor, though he was an alcoholic, which was probably the more important requirement of the two. Peabody was born in 1892 to one of the most distinguished families in Boston. The Peabodys were wealthy New England blue bloods, well connected with the social elite. He attended Harvard and married Polly Jacob, who was not only the niece of banking magnate J.P. Morgan Jr., but had received a patent for the modern brassiere. When you're not only connected with the Morgan family, but married to the woman who created the bra, life's pretty good. Unless you're an alcoholic. Peabody's drinking became a habit at Harvard and intensified during his service in World War I. He squandered his wife's inheritance on a shipping business which failed. He drank more heavily, becoming violent and abusive, until finally his wife left him, taking her brassieres. A broken man, he began attending meetings at a local church where he developed his own technique of mind hacking. He eventually achieved sobriety and opened an office to help other alcoholics find sobriety as well. He helped so many, in fact, that they gave him the affectionate nickname Dr. Peabody. In 1931, he wrote a book titled The Common Sense of Drinking that outlined his techniques. The book not only became a bestseller, but is a mind-hacking classic. He was one of the first to claim that once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic, and there's no use in trying to drink more responsibly, despite what the beer commercials tell you. To Peabody, complete sobriety is the only option, and he warns of the dangerous tricks that your mind will play on you as you try to give up drinking. Much of his program involves consciously developing new habits of thought that will mentally gird you when these inevitable temptations arise. You must overrun the old thought habits with new ones, he says. In a technology analogy appropriate to his time period, he likens the mind to a muddy dirt road that is overrun by the hoof prints of horses and carriages. You can't easily get rid of these mental tracks unless you drive through with a newfangled automobile, creating new tracks. The mind has a similar pliability, what modern researchers call neuroplasticity, or the ability to create new neural pathways in the brain. To accomplish this changing of the mind, one of the fundamental techniques in Peabody's book is for the recovering alcoholic to write down the next day's schedule. Every item that he or she wishes to accomplish, including both work and rest. He recommends writing down the day's activities in detail, beginning from the time of arising and continuing until bed at night. Then, at the end of the day, the patient reviews the day's schedule, then plans for tomorrow, again, writing it down. The purpose of the schedule is to change a negative loop, drinking, feeling terrible, and so drinking some more, into a positive one, making progress, feeling better, and so making more progress. Note the similarities with Benjamin Franklin's Moral Perfection Project, where he reviewed his progress each day in adhering to his values, writing down whether the day was a success. One of Peabody's patients gives this testimonial about the virtues of writing down his daily schedule. Quote, "This issuance of small commands to myself and my obedience to them rapidly restored my self-respect. Incidentally, my efficiency in my daily work enormously increased, which increased the respect for me of other people. This reacted favorably on my confidence in myself. In other words, by perfectly mechanical means, I was enabled to turn what had been a vicious circle into a beneficent circle. The more pride I was able to take in myself, the less need I had of the rallying effect of alcohol when I went out." Unquote. Along the way, Peabody is teaching the alcoholic new habits of thought, cutting new mental grooves in the mind. He is also teaching various concentration and relaxation exercises, positive mental loops, and other techniques similar to the ones you're learning in this book. The common sense of drinking was a great help to me as I was getting sober. I wasn't the only one. The book also had a profound influence on another man named Bill Wilson, who went on to help another alcoholic or two. The cocktail napkin. It's a classic Silicon Valley idea. Two entrepreneurs are having drinks in a bar and develop a business model so brilliant that they breathlessly scribble it out on a cocktail napkin. A second cocktail napkin is usually used to draft up a quick NDA. The business on a cocktail napkin meme is so popular because it boils this truth down to its essence. A good idea can only be developed if you write it down. In practice, building a successful business is a little more complicated. Still, writing it down is a critical and surprisingly complicated discipline, as anyone who has ever tried to write a business plan can tell you. As an entrepreneur, one of the most influential business books I've read is Michael E. Gerber's The E-Myth Revisited, Why Most Small Businesses Don't Work and What to Do About It, which has sold over 1 million copies worldwide. It outlines what Gerber calls the entrepreneurial myth that most new businesses are started not by entrepreneurs, but by technicians who enjoy doing the work and want to work for themselves. For example, a software developer decides he can make more money working as a hired gun than as a full-time employee, so he starts his own business. His skill set is programming, and that's what he loves, so he starts out doing all the hands-on programming work himself. As the company grows, however, his bias toward working in the business will begin to overshadow what he should be doing, working on the business. What Gerber recommends is for the entrepreneur to think of his or her business like a franchise operation. Imagine it as a fully contained system, like Edison's R&D laboratory, that can be used to grow and expand to future locations. You probably know a small business that has stayed in the same place for years, never growing, making just enough for their owners to feed their families. Maybe it's a local restaurant or a neighborhood dry cleaner. If the owner is able to shift his or her mental mindset from "this is my business" to "this is a prototype of my business," that can make all the difference. One of the fundamental techniques Gerber recommends is writing it down. In other words, looking at every process and system within your business and making it a replicable process that can be clearly written out step by step and put into a training manual that can be used to start a new office or store that is exactly like the original. Thinking in this way causes the entrepreneur to shift out of working in the business mode and get into working on the business mode. Gerber's advice is useful not just for small businesses and startups, but also for mind hackers. Instead of just working in the mind, we are also working on the mind. We are looking not just at our thoughts, but at the process of those thoughts and how they affect our lives. Just like Gerber's business owners, we must take the time to write down, step by step, what we want our minds to think. Or we will be like the business owner who spends her entire life running to stay in the same place. At my content marketing company, Media Shower, writing things down is what we do. A huge network of talented writers and editors create great content for our clients' websites and blogs. Still, writing down our business processes is another matter entirely. And only through constant repetition have we been able to turn this into a healthy habit. If we're documenting how one of our editors should review a writer's work, for example, we start out by writing down the process on a whiteboard, usually as a simple flowchart. Once we get basic agreement, we write up the process in an online document. The ground rules are: keep it short. If it's too long, no one will read it. Keep it simple. We do this for new employees, so anyone should be able to understand it. Keep it flexible. things change, so anyone should be able to edit the document at any time. At most companies I've seen, the employee training manual, if they have one at all, is an enormous 3-ring binder written a decade ago, full of procedures that no one actually follows, locked up in a middle manager's closet under a bowling trophy. At Media Shower, it's a collection of short, simple online documents that can evolve with our business. And when we no longer use a particular document, what do? We delete it. The goal in writing things down is not to write everything down, but to strive for the same level of economy and elegance as a well-written line of code. Scott Ambler, a proponent of agile development, argues that programmers should not focus huge amounts of time on writing documentation for their software, but strive for documentation that's just barely good enough, or JBGE. This does not mean ineffective or not very good, but actually the most effective possible, as documentation that has just enough information is one that most people are actually likely to read. In the spirit of JBGE, I'll shut up now. Begin call out. Don't get it perfect, get it done. End call out. The 2-week textbook. On a summer day in 1999, Alan Downey sat down in his office at Colby College and did something radical. He started to write a programming textbook. There's nothing radical about writing a college textbook, of course, provided you have several years, a team of peer reviewers, and a patient editor. Downey's goal, however, was to get it written before class started, in 2 weeks. Most textbooks are unreadable, dense, and boring, Downey told me, 1,000-page books with no personality. There were plenty of textbooks available for his introductory course on the Java programming language, for example, but each chapter was typically 50 pages or more, and many students couldn't slog through the reading. Worse, the material was poorly organized. The first few chapters were easy, but then the trapdoor opened and students fell through the floor. Very predictably, in chapter 5, I knew the students' heads were going to explode, he remembered. There was too much, too new, too fast. So, as he furiously developed his own textbook in that 14-day marathon, he took a different approach. I saw it like fold-out bleachers, he explained. If you've got a difficult concept, it can either be a wall, or you can pull it out to allow the students to jump over it. So if I know there will be a wall in chapter 5, I can pull some of that material forward to give them a step up in chapter 2, then another step in chapter 3, so when I get to the hard part, they can get over it. Unbelievably, he finished the book in time for his first class, writing 1 10-page chapter a day for 13 straight days. Part of that was accumulated frustration, he laughed. I knew exactly what I wanted by that point, so I could write it down very quickly. In the spirit of just barely good enough, he streamlined each chapter to 10 pages, explaining each concept as simply as possible. And because he owned the textbook, he could now focus on making it better. Each week, he gave his students a quiz on their weekly reading assignment so he could get instant feedback on what was working. Now I'm running in a tight feedback loop. If the students read chapter 3 and everybody does well on the reading quiz, then I can move on. If everybody reads chapter 3 and nobody can do the reading quiz, that tells me instantly there is something wrong with chapter 3 that I need to fix for the next iteration. In agile programming, Downey's textbook would be called a minimal viable product, which, like JBGE, lets us quickly release a product so that we can test, learn, and improve. Compare this with the alternate approach, which we might call maximum perfect product. That is, we can only release software that is 100% bug-free, we can only write books that have been edited to perfection, and we can only write down personal goals once we have deemed them to be absolutely perfect. Even with its flaws, Downey found that his textbook was far better than the textbook he had been using, and this rapid feedback loop helped him iterate quickly. By the time he had taken two or three classes of students through the book, he had developed something that was working very well. In a beautiful bit of meta-creation, Downey had applied great programming philosophy to his own programming textbook. Release early, release often, get feedback, and improve. But that was only one of the things that made Downey's textbook experiment so radical. The other was that he gave the textbook away for free. In subsequent years, he developed several textbooks, including How to Think Like a Computer Scientist, and distributed them under Richard Stallman's GNU license, which means that readers are free to copy, modify, and distribute them. He started his own publishing company, guided by one simple manifesto. Students should read and understand textbooks. That's it. Giving away his work spread it to a worldwide audience. His free textbooks have now been translated into multiple spoken languages, French, German, Mandarin, etc., and adapted for multiple programming languages, Ruby, Python, Eiffel, etc. As his fame grew, the premier technical publisher O'Reilly Media contracted him to write a new series of textbooks. He received an offer to become a visiting scientist at Google, and he's now a professor of computer science at the prestigious Frank W. Olin College of Engineering. Not bad for a two-week writing rampage. Concentrate, then write. One of the reasons I've been so adamant about writing things down throughout this book is because of the power that comes from writing. The magnificent capability we all have of creating something from nothing. With mind hacking, you are like an architect creating a blueprint for your life. And blueprints are only useful if they're actually written down. That's why they're not called blue thoughts. Your mind hacking skills will be greatly strengthened by simply writing things down after your daily concentration game, which I trust you have been diligently practicing since section 1.4. The idea is to spend 20 minutes in concentration, then a few minutes writing your positive loops. It's a total time commitment of less than half an hour. If you were going to school for an advanced degree or working on a big new project, you would expect to spend far more than half an hour a day. How much more important is working on your own mind? Far more valuable than learning a new skill or getting a certificate, the time you invest each week in mind hacking is time that will pay off for the rest of your life. It's never been easier to write things down. You probably carry your phone with you everywhere, which will work as long as you don't mind mashing tiny screen keys with your meaty, oversized thumbs. You probably also spend most of the workday in front of your computer, another easy way to write things down. Don't overlook the power of the old-school pen and notepad. Seeing the pages fill up day after day is something you don't get on a digital device. After you've practiced the concentration game in section 1.4, turn to the practice sheet and write down your five mental loops from the section feel, do, have, give, and be. For example, I'm free from anxiety and feeling great. I will write a novel with best-selling potential. I will own a beach house, which I will share with my family and friends. I will start a nonprofit to help kids learn to read. I'm a dependable mother, wife, and friend. This practice is important for several reasons. First, writing things down reminds you of your goals on a regular basis. It's easy for our minds to get distracted, and this re-centers your attention on what you have defined for yourself as most important. Writing down your positive loops cements them into your mind. The research backs it up. Writing things down is more likely to lead to large-scale change. Certain types of writing have a surprisingly quick and large impact, says psychologist Richard Wiseman in his research-based 59 Seconds, Change Your Life in Under a Minute. expressing gratitude, thinking about a perfect future, and affectionate writing, techniques you've learned throughout this book, have been scientifically proven to work, and all they require is a pen, a piece of paper, and a few moments of your time. We talked about Laura King's studies in which test subjects were asked to spend time writing about their best possible future self, and how just a few weeks of this simple exercise led participants to be quantifiably happier and healthier. By writing down your five positive loops from the previous section on a daily basis after your concentration game, you can experience the same benefit. Second, writing things down offers you an opportunity to reflect. You may find that valuable insights and ideas come to you during your concentration practice. By building in this Edison-like system for capturing them immediately afterward, you're more likely to do something with them. Think of it as your internal R&D lab. Third, writing things down gives you a chance to improve. As with Alan Downey's programming textbook, once he had written the initial draft, he could then test it with real students and continue to improve it over time. Many people are frozen by the need to get it perfect, but that's not how great programmers work, and it's not how nature works. In the spirit of just barely good enough, write it down and let it evolve. Most important, there is incredible mind-altering power in repetition. We'll talk more about that power next. Begin mind game. Right now. After completing your daily concentration game, write down each of your positive loops on your practice sheet. End mind game. 3.2. Repeat. Scott Adams, the creator of the Dilbert comic empire, is one of the most successful cartoonists of our time. In addition to being published in thousands of newspapers worldwide, Dilbert has been spun off into several best-selling books, an animated series, and hundreds of Dilbert-themed toys and games. But at one time, Scott Adams was just another mid-level office drone in a large bureaucratic organization, just like Dilbert. Adams had always dreamed of becoming a cartoonist. From an early age, he adored Charles Schulz's Peanuts and felt that drawing such a strip would one day be his career. As an adult, however, he found himself working a number of humiliating and low-paying jobs in Northern California. He was continually looking for a way out so he could make his cartooning dream a reality. A friend told him about a repetition technique where you write down your positive mental loop 15 times each day. His friend claimed that it worked for her. "The thing that caught my attention," he related, "is that the process doesn't require any faith or positive thinking to work. Just the act of writing down your loop," she claimed, "was enough to make it happen." In the spirit of self-experimentation, and figuring that he had nothing to lose but time, Adams gave it a try. His first attempt was the straightforward, "I, Scott Adams, will become rich." In his books, The Dilbert Future and How to Fail at Almost Everything and Still Win Big, he tells the story of making two ridiculously lucky stock picks that came to him out of the blue that year. Both were long shots, and both ended up being among the top market stories that year. He sold both stocks immediately, so he wasn't rich, but the odds of an amateur picking two red-hot winners seemed unlikely. He was less skeptical of the technique, but still not quite a believer. He decided to try the technique on another goal, getting an MBA from University of California at Berkeley. He had already taken the GMAT test that's required for MBA applications and scored in the 77th percentile, not good enough for UC Berkeley. So he began writing down this positive loop 15 times each day. "I, Scott Adams, will score in the 94th percentile on the GMAT." In the weeks leading up to the test, he bought GMAT study books and took plenty of practice tests. Each time, he scored at about the 77th percentile. Still, he patiently wrote down his positive loop over and over, 15 times each day. The day of the test came. He took the test, feeling that he had scored about the same. He kept up the repetition technique as he waited for the GMAT test scores to arrive in the mail. Finally, the test results came. He took the envelope out of the mailbox, opened it, and looked at the box he had pictured in his mind so many times before. He scored in exactly the 94th percentile. Adams recounts, quote, "That evening, I sat in a chair with the GMAT results next to me, alternately staring at the wall and then staring at the 94. I kept expecting it to change. It didn't. And that night, I knew that nothing would ever be the same for me. Everything I thought I knew about how the universe was wired was wrong." Unquote. After earning his MBA, still working his day job, he began repeating a new loop. Each morning, before he left for work, he would get up at 4 o'clock a.m. to draw what would eventually become Dilbert. He also began to write this positive loop 15 times each day. "I, Scott Adams, will become a syndicated cartoonist." Despite a number of setbacks and rejections, and through a series of unlikely coincidences and lucky breaks, he eventually became a syndicated cartoonist. In fact, he's arguably the most syndicated cartoonist alive today. Dilbert is published in 2,000 newspapers worldwide, in 65 countries, and in 25 languages. With his analytical mind, Adams tried to reverse engineer why this technique works in his books and in various posts to his blog. While he called his experiences with the repetition technique fascinating and puzzling, as well as wonderful and inexplicable, he also was careful not to attribute them to voodoo or magic. Instead, he theorized about a logical explanation, even acknowledging that it might be nothing more than selective memory. Perhaps he tried the repetition technique multiple times, but only remembered his successes. Adams points to research done by the psychiatrist Richard Wiseman, in which he studied people who described themselves as lucky. It turns out they didn't have any special powers, except for one, they were more likely to notice opportunities. As Adams puts it, optimistic people's field of perception is literally greater. If you're methodically repeating your goals each day, you're more likely to notice the people and situations that can help you achieve those goals as they present themselves. In my experience, this is absolutely true. When you repeat your goals daily, you set your expectations accordingly, and you begin viewing situations in a different light. If you're repeating your goal of losing weight and someone invites you to a kickboxing class, you see it as an opportunity, not another way to embarrass yourself. If you're repeating your goal of becoming an entrepreneur and they're going through layoffs at your day job, you might see it as an opportunity to take the severance package and strike out on your own. Adams also points out that repeatedly writing things down takes effort. Because you are investing time and energy in this small goal, you are committing yourself to investing time and energy in your larger goal. It is a way of kickstarting your mind into achieving your dreams, a kind of mental bootstrapping. My favorite explanation also has the least evidence to support it, Adams concludes, i.e., none. In this explanation, reality is so mind-bogglingly complex that our minds simply deliver a highly simplified illusion that we treat as facts. In this model of reality, the constant repetition of our goals may be a lever that we use to create some natural chain of cause and effect, but not a chain we are capable of understanding. So when the results come, by what appears to be luck or coincidence, it is simply by natural laws that are not yet fully understood. While this view is unlikely to be correct, he admits, It has the advantage of being totally cool to think about. It is also similar to the ideas of Plato and the Matrix. A deeper reality lies behind this one. In the end, Adams's repetition technique is one of the easiest self-experiments you can try. It's totally free, and you have nothing to lose but your time. Here's a good test of your personality, Adams concludes in response to the skeptics. If all of your friends told you that they win money on the slot machines whenever they stick their fingers in their own ears, would you try it? Or would you assume that since there is no obvious reason it could work, it's not worth the effort? Repetition is key. Repetition is key. Also, repetition is key. One of the best parts about living in Boston, besides the wealth of technology talent, is sledding in the winter. It's a thrill-seeker's dream because you can sled as long as you want, as often as you want, and unlike roller coasters or hallucinogens, it's totally free. I live near Wellesley College, the renowned all-women's college that has produced notable alumni like Nora Ephron and Hillary Clinton. Wellesley has a sledding hill that is just phenomenally dangerous. It has what feels like an 85-degree incline where you attain what feels like speeds of up to 75 miles per hour. On one side of the hill, a 15-foot oak branch spreads out across the snow like a giant deadly limbo stick. If you don't press your body flat into the sled, you will be decapitated by the tree. It's insane that they allow sledding on the hill at all, but even more insane is that the women of Wellesley College sled down the hill on plastic trays from the dining hall. It's funnier if you picture Hillary Clinton on a tray. As any sledding enthusiast knows, if you get to the hill after a fresh snow, it's just clean powder. Then, as people sled down the hill, it creates grooves or tracks in the snow. After a few days, the Wellesley students have built snow ramps and moguls at the bottom so that sledding down one of these tracks will launch you into orbit. A few days after a snow, you'll find one set of snow tracks that take you under the oak tree of death and another set that will shoot you off the ramps into hyperspace. Even if you start your sled on another area of the hill, you end up locking into one of those two tracks. Our minds are like that hill. The constant repetition of our negative loops cuts deep mental grooves, and it's natural for our minds to lock into those grooves, even when the negative loops are self-destructive. The good news is, through repetition, you can cut a new groove. When I take my kids sledding at the hill, we often have to cut a new track, packing down the snow where we want it to go, then physically slowing and redirecting ourselves to the new track. The sled wants to lock into the existing groove, but by patiently working the new path, we can eventually get the sled to lock into the new one instead. Through the concentration and writing exercises that you're practicing, you're probably already seeing when the mind begins to go down one of these dangerous paths. Everything I do ends in failure, sadness, embarrassment. I'm a terrible parent, partner, friend. I'm no good at exercise, math, romance. I shouldn't have said, done, thought that. I'm fat, lonely, hopeless. The sled has started down the hill, but if you develop the skill of noticing it going down this track, then you can develop the skill of redirecting it to a different track, preferably with one of your positive loops. Everything I do ends in failure, but hold on. Some things I do are actually quite successful, like the homemade Transformers outfit I built for Comic-Con last year. I'm a terrible parent, but wait a minute. My son gave me a hug yesterday out of the blue. Like all parents, I have room to improve, but I'm doing something right. I'm no good at exercise. Actually, I have been working out twice a week for the last month, so although it still doesn't feel natural, I'm getting better. I shouldn't have said that, but you know what? I'm probably the only one who will even remember it, and I'm growing more self-confident every day. I'm lonely, but the good news is that I just joined a church, I'm widening my circle of friends, and I'm confident I'll find a loving partner.